It's Sunday morning. Time for the Great Outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Your host, Charlie Potter, here on WGN Radio. And hope that you'll enjoy this morning's show as spring is trying to spring. But that was earlier in the week, and now, my gosh, we're back into what seems like winter. But the birds are telling us things are about to happen, and I'm going to start off this morning with a story that I know a lot of biologists might disagree with me on. My question is, how long can a robin live? For 6 years now, about this time of the year, about the 1st of April, for 6 years running, a robin has arrived on my side rear-view window of my truck, where it proceeds to spend the day, the morning, leaving its droppings all over my rear-view mirror and windshield, side of the windshield, my window. And the reason I know it's the same robin, or assume it's the same robin, is it began 6 years ago in the spring. A bird arrived, perched itself up on my rearview mirror, side mirror of the car, and sat there and made a mess. And I would come out in the morning, and I'd have to wash it off, and the bird would fly away. That same bird then flies to our kitchen window and sees its reflection. It's a male robin, sees its reflection in the window, and attacks the window because it's fighting for territory while the female robin is nesting nearby. I can't believe it would be a different bird that would sit on the exact, and I've changed cars over the six-year period now, I have another car, that would sit on my side rearview mirror on the driver's side, never on the passenger side, just the driver's side, the way I park, sits there for day after day in the morning, not only making a mess of my car, which I can clean up, then flies once the sun gets up enough and on a sunny day hits the window and flies and attacks our kitchen window. So I know biologists say that birds are very short-lived. A robin's probably, a life cycle of a robin is probably, the average life cycle is probably less than a year. A dove, mourning dove, all these small birds are less than a year. Obviously, some birds make it more than a year, or they would be extinct. But how long, I wonder, can a robin actually live? Up to what age? Because I have to believe that this is the same male robin 6 years running. So that to me is the sign of spring. It's also the sign of every morning having to go and wet down a towel and clean off my car. I don't mind doing that. But it's kind of fun to know that each year now this bird comes back and my kids, each year we're saying, can it come back? And my gosh, showed up 2 days ago. After the couple of warm days we had, there it was in my yard. So one of the miracles of nature, birds have incredible homing instincts, and we tend to forget that they have such great homing instincts. But they really do. They have a way of finding their way back to the places where they nested more often than we might realize. I'm going to shift from the story of the robin on my car to what's taking place now in the aftermath of the Malheur refuge standoff, which was, of course, on national news earlier this year. And what makes me comment on it today is because I think only the government could come up with a $6 million cleanup bill for a interpretive center where this federal, where the standoff occurred over 43 days with the only way you can describe it is the anarchists. And as you know, the Fish and Wildlife Service let them stay there, did not try to take them out. And at the end, there was conflict and there was a fatality. But the estimated costs announced by Dan Ash, the director of the Fish and Wildlife Service, to clean up the interpretive center is $6 million. And I don't know if that strikes you the way it strikes me. You could tear the whole thing down and build probably 10 interpretive centers for $6 million. One of the costs that is absolutely stunning. And there really should be an audit of this. And I put this under the occasionally, you know, I don't want to say a lampoon, but I highlight areas of the government that really you just have to wonder how they can spend their money like this. It cost an estimated $2 million to house the employees of the National Wildlife Refuge during the standoff. The government felt that they had to remove them from the area for their own safety and then paid for the entire time of the standoff, the 40-plus days, for the employees, 30-some, to be in motels, fed, transportation. How is it possible to run up a $2 million bill over 40 days for 30 people with lodging? We're in rural America. They're not staying at the Ritz-Carlton in Chicago or the Plaza Hotel in New York. This is cheap housing. And I guess the other question would be why, since not all these people lived at the refuge by any means, why did we have to, the taxpayers, pay for them to go be taken somewhere else? They could have stayed home. So these are the kind of things when we talk about the mismanagement of government resources. And in this case, it's our resources, it's our tax dollars that are coming out of the Fish and Wildlife Service budget that it was intended for to be used for fish and wildlife management. And we end up paying these kind of bills. It is beyond comprehension for that 17 employees is the actual number, cost $2 million to house for 41 days. I would love, just as a private citizen, to see the expense account. I have no idea if they ate caviar every day, if they flew them to Malibu and they went to the beach. I'm being facetious on that, obviously. But it is impossible to run up for 17 people a $2 million hotel bill in rural America for 41 days. But that's how the United States government operates, and we wonder why we have such horrific expenses. This is one that I think could be pretty easily run down. It's a single case, but the point of us spending $6 million on a refuge that is in a remote part of America to rebuild the interpretive center and spend $2 million just so people could go live somewhere else for a period of 40 days shows, I think, government irresponsibility and misuse of funds that are dedicated actually to the management of fish and wildlife resources. So we'll probably hear more about it, but that is my big black hole of the day report on the United States government Fish and Wildlife Service. I'm sure it was a terrible experience for the individuals who work in the refuge to not be able to go to work for 41 days. But there has to be some accountability how we could spend that amount of money. Before I take a break, I am going to talk very quickly about an animal that was caught recently in northeastern Illinois, which has been gone from this part of the landscape for a long, long time. And that is a badger. Badger State, of course, is just to our north. And there were at one time many, many badgers in Wisconsin and also across Illinois. They were exterminated from Illinois well over a century and a half ago. In most cases, badgers are ferocious animals, much like a wolverine. You got the Michigan wolverines, you got the Wisconsin badgers. Badgers are a really, really strong predator, very, very efficient predator, and one tough animal. And a couple weeks ago, a male badger was captured by a leading research technician from the Max McGraw Wildlife Foundation while working on a coyote project. He caught it on March 10th, not far from the Fox River. So it is, I believe, the first badger that has been trapped in Illinois. It was in a live trap, has been trapped in Illinois. It was implanted with a transmitter and released back into the wild to be able to monitor its activities. But it is quite a story that an animal that has really been few and far between in Illinois for over 100 years appears once again to be back in our midst. I'll be back in just a moment with more on the Great Outdoors Show, and I thank you very much for joining us. When I come back, I'm going to talk a little about the economic impact of hunting and fishing, and as the Wisconsin primary is nearly upon us, I want to talk a little bit about that on Tuesday, and as Wisconsin is one of the great states for outdoor recreation, and the sound is deafening of the candidates talking about the things that we care about, hunting, fishing, outdoor recreation. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN, and first a message from your Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
Winter is here, and it's always tough on the road. But when the going gets tough, the tough get going. And nothing is tougher than the 2016 Chevy Silverado. Silverado is the longest-lasting, most dependable pickup on the road. With all-steel construction, Silverado is built to tame Chicago's winter weather. And Silverado's towing package offers 11,400 pounds of towing capacity. Perfect for hauling your snowmobiles. I love pulling my neighbors out of their snowdrifts. And right now, you can get $7,250 total savings on a 2016 Chevy Silverado All-Star. $7,250. That really warms my heart. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and get all the details. Or head to your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer today and pick up a pickup that works as hard as you do, on the road or off. Chevy Silverado is one tough customer.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. Hope that you're enjoying the show this morning. What I wanted to quickly touch on is the first report that we've had, the very first report on breeding conditions out of the prairies of the United States and Canada, the birthplace to so many of the migratory waterfowl and wetland-dependent birds on the continent. For the first time in a long time, like maybe almost 20 years, we are looking at exceptionally dry conditions across much of the prime breeding grounds of the prairies. We have not had a widespread drought on the prairie breeding ground since 1993, the single longest extended period in recorded history of basically generally favorable to extremely favorable breeding conditions. A lot can change. There still is time for a couple of significant snowfall events across that part of the world in April. But it right now looks as though, and if the trend is your friend, it right now looks as though we are going to have a difficult breeding season for migratory waterfowl and wetland-dependent birds. That is the first time, as I said a moment ago, that we've had that sort of scenario in a long time. We have about, well, really, we only have about 30 days to fix it. And if we don't see significant fronts moving across Alberta into Saskatchewan and across eastern Montana into the Dakotas, it is going to be set up to be a very, very subpar breeding season for waterfowl. That does not mean that the breeding population index is going to fall significantly. It simply means that the reproduction is going to fall, which basically means we lag for a year, sometimes two, due to the extended life periods of waterfowl, that one breeding season does not diminish the breeding population substantially. It's the following year when there's been no recruitment or young of the year coming into the population that can definitely have an impact on the population. So that's the news. We'll stay posted on that. I want to shift north of the state line for just a moment. The Wisconsin primary is on Tuesday. We can't get away from it, it seems like. It's just all consuming on the news. But certainly what we can get away from is the apparent discussion of any interest in natural resources, hunting, fishing, outdoor recreation in the state of Wisconsin, which is one of America's hallmark states for economic activity, the number of individuals who hunt and fish. It is absolutely, to me, shocking that we're in the midst, as far as we are, into this primary season, and you cannot find any discussion about conservation. Yeah, there's been a little bit of talk about the Keystone Pipeline, but that's not really about conservation. That's much more about politics and the environmental groups trying to stop progress, because there's a great chance for mitigation on that. But really, Wisconsin, which I looked up recently, Wisconsin has about $2.2 billion of economic activity related to hunting in the most recent time period measured. That is unbelievable. And they, in Wisconsin, collect over $35 million in state taxes and an additional roughly $35 million in federal taxes. So that means that hunting alone in Wisconsin contributed $70 million in taxes, half to the state, half to the federal government. It is in the top five in America for providing income to the federal government. And it is absolutely unbelievable that you can have the kind of discussion we are without any candidate talking about in depth the importance of our outdoor recreation heritage in the state of Wisconsin. So I think it goes to show this is a very different election. You may recall in 2012, both Mitt Romney and President Obama had very robust teams trying to court people who hunted. Certainly, many of you remember the infamous John Kerry with the goose over his shoulder photo. There's none of that this time. It's as though the outdoors don't even exist. And that is something that is really tragic. We'll talk more about it in the coming weeks and certainly as we move towards November. But hunting and fishing is a huge multi-billion-dollar industry in America, and it deserves respect and attention at a national level by those people who would like to be president of the United States. At least those are my feelings. So I thank you very much for joining me this morning. Next week, I'll be back much more in the great outdoors. Turkey season is about to open all around us. So that is a time when many people finally can get out. Many of us can finally get out of the winter and head out to the woods and have a great week in the great outdoors. I'll be back next Sunday morning. This is Charlie Potter, the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.